I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am, but Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
All right. Hey, welcome to Going Off Track.
Hey.
I'm Jonah.
I'm Brad.
I'm Steven.
And Steven's here.
Steve. That's Stephen.
Stephen.
Not
Stephen.
To be confused.
Not
with
to be confused with Steven. Steven Smith, who was at this podcast, I believe.
Lizzie.
I believe we had both Stevens. I believe we had the whole crew for this one.
Steven.
This was a lot of dudes.
Oh, yeah. It was a lot of dudes and our guest.
One girl. Poor girl.
Lizzie Goodman, a really good friend.
She handled it well.
She did. She's a pro. She was here promoting her book, Meet Me in the Bathroom, Rebirth and Rock and Roll in New York City, 2001 to 2011. The book is out now. Lizzie definitely doesn't need us. She was on Seth Meyers' show talking about it. She's done a lot of huge TV appearances. The book is everywhere.
It's impressive.
It is incredibly
oral
impressive.
Oral history is... impressive, yeah. Undertaking.
Yeah, she spent 5 or 6 years on this. We talk about that a lot. But yeah, it seems like, I know what you're thinking. You guys did this interview a little while ago. Why didn't you just release it when the book came out? Because that's when everyone was releasing their interviews. We thought we'd wait till the buzz started really going. It's a strategic move.
Well, we wanted to see how much buzz there was.
Yeah.
We thought we might not release it if it wasn't
totally.
If it wasn't enough hype.
But once they got once she got the Tonight Show thing, we're like, all right, I guess, or the Seth Meyers thing. I thought, yeah, let's just release it. So
let's not give away too much of our. You know, plotting and behind the scenes.
Brad hates it when I recap the whole podcast beforehand.
No, I'm just saying our strategy. We don't want other podcasts to steal our strategy.
True. Yeah, you should see how many podcasts we have we just never released because we're like, didn't really get a lot of buzz.
Yeah, exactly.
Throw it in the recycle bin.
Yep. We'll save that one for when their career maybe takes off.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, that's good. So we have a whole backlog of talking about current events that are totally dated. But this was a really good one. So happy Lizzie made time for us to come by. The book's awesome. And let's just get into it.
I think it'll sell itself.
Yeah, it'll sell itself. Yeah, and if you like this, order the book.
Word.
It's available now at your local bookseller. All right, here's Lizzie Goodman.
It's going off track!
My list of comics that I can't afford to buy anymore and first grade teachers I hope my kids don't get.
This is a great metaphor. Your first grade teachers you hope your kids don't get.
Yes.
So you don't have a positive list. You have a like absolute.
No, they're mostly they're positive, but there's the one mom who's like, she's like, oh no, they're terrible.
Yeah, but don't. It's like the don't playlist at your wedding.
It's, yeah.
Oh.
You know about that? It's like you don't give the DJ the playlist, you give them the don't playlist.
But that's who we hired for our wedding. It was a company out of Philly called No Macarena. And they would say, even if you ask, we won't play. And they listed all these songs. And I was like, here's a sum of money. And then I did the whole playlist.
No Macarena was really
that was the name of the company.
Oh,
and Dave Hawes told me about it. And he was like, you have to do this. And so I gave them all his money. I gave them money, and then I gave them the playlist.
A sum, I think you said.
They said, at the end of it, they said, basically, you just rented our PA. All we did was just play what you put.
And you're like, you're right welcome.
It's like,
I
thanks.
Did a great job at my wedding.
Thank you.
I hired a great band. They ripped it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And when I was listening, I was like, basically, I'm like, I just don't want white vocalists or a shitty drummer. and then I can deal with it. And
that
I
was found, your don't playlist.
And you know what? It worked out perfect.
Yeah. Who is this band?
Oh my God.
What are they called? Uh-oh, busted.
Good night. Memorable night.
I never go on my phone at a podcast, but I'm doing it here because their
it's
name
important
is
that
too
you
much.
Do this.
Let's move on to something else, and I'm going to blow all your minds with Benny, the name
of $5 an edit. You know that, right?
Oh, shit.
To make you look good.
So, Lizzie, you wrote a book.
I did. It's crazy.
Are you sick of talking about it? Or you like talking
about it? No, I'm so excited. I can't believe it's still that point where I'm just like, oh my God, other people are going to read it.
How long start to finish would you say from like conceptualizing it to like what's happening now?
Literally. Okay. So this is funny because I remember that when I went to interview those guys, which I think was it's 6 years. It's
six years.
5 years of writing. I had sold the book right before I went to do that Gaslight interview because I remember that Ken, to prep them about who the hell I was like, yeah, she, I don't know, this writer in New York, she just sold this book. But the New York rock scene, which of course at the time could mean absolutely nothing other than like, great, good for her. Do we have to like toast her or something at the interview? I don't know. But it was there, you know, there was a sense of like their publicists had prepared them for dealing with me by announcing the news that I was going to write it.
And it was sort of as if like at the time, especially we needed like more like, oh, you should really do this Times piece that's going to be in the Sunday Times. You could have told me fucking Elmer Fudd was writing it. No offense to you.
And I'm not offended.
Stoked. It was like there was nothing that could have happened that would have made us say no in any way.
It was extra cred for me.
So that was Weinstein just going out of
Weinstein was
way.
Like feeling the need to like really rub it in or something. But I remember being
he
like,
likes buttering people up.
Yeah. But it was funny because I was like, oh, right, I'm going to write that. Because there's that space between like, I told everyone I'd write this book and a reality of actually doing it.
I remember you mentioning it, and I think I said something like, oh, so nothing really daunting.
God.
Like, how do you...
If you said that, I should have listened to you.
Yeah, like,
what a crazy...
Do you just make...
I'm a crazy, like, a stupid, stupid person decided to do this.
So do you just, like, go down and make a list of all the people you want to talk to, and then, like, outline it out, and then just, like, just...
First what you do is convince your, like, you have to be insane. Like, I was just like, that should get done. Someone should totally do an oral history. Like, I went and saw both the shows that the book ends with. Like, LC Sound System's then final show, which is hilarious now to consider that that's what they were saying, but... good for them.
They said it many times.
They said it many times. It was said more than once. It was believed by many, probably even them. I went to that show and I saw the Strokes play MSG the same couple day period, and I was like, huh. Like, I remember feeling during that experience of seeing those shows back to back that like there was sort of this that bands that I'd considered mine or somehow kind of peers were like establishment. I have said this before at this point, but I watched, like, Susan Sarandon was at the LCD Sound System show, and I'm obsessed with Susan Sarandon, and I could see her the whole time. So I basically did not really see the LCD Sound System show. I saw Susan Sarandon watching the LCD Sound System show, and I would be like, oh, she likes that. Oh, interesting. Oh, like, what's she doing now? Oh, she needs
did
to get a beer.
Did she know the lyrics?
She was like singing along sometime. Yeah, wow. I know. And so it was sort of like, okay, that's interesting. And then, that was 2011, like spring of 2011. And then it took me a year to kind of, during that time was the crazy person took over and was like, yeah, you should write a book about this. And that book should be an oral history because those aren't hard.
I can't even imagine.
I'd never written one.
Yeah. Like what? So you'd never written one. I know we've all read a bunch, but like,
yeah.
Who do you go to say, what's step one of an oral history?
Well, first I had to sell it so that I would have a shitload of pressure to actually make it happen. I don't do anything without, like, that's the actual secret. Like, convince people who will sue you if you don't deliver it that you can do a thing that you think somebody should do.
Can you tell someone from the outside, like, what that process is like? Because it seems, I would have no concept of how you go from, like, just the idea of a book to actually getting someone to agree with it. And then what are the terms after as far as like, when do you have to deliver and what do you have to deliver and stuff?
Sure. Okay, so the first step is that you conceive of like if you're making an album and you have a really strong notion for what you want it to feel like to listen to. Not yeah. even necessarily what you want it to sound sure. like, but like you're not going to demo it out. You're just going to say, okay, so when you're playing this record, you're going to feel like you're 16 and you just bought a Camaro and you're driving down the Pacific Coast Highway or something. I mean, you know, whatever it is. Just for example. not that I've ever great. Thought about muscle cars in the Pacific Coast Highway. But, and then you like build out. So it's like that. Like I basically said, here's how it will feel to read this book. And, but the way, you know, you do that by saying, I will have these sources and I will have those sources. But because you can basically say, I will execute X, Y, or Z thing without any actual proof that you will be able to do that,
right.
you can fantasize about a theoretical perfect product. And it's both totally dangerous to do that in that you have no idea if you can deliver it, but it's also really helpful because then if it, in this case, it, they believed me, then you do have a kind of benchmark for what you want it to look like. So the actual, it took me almost a year to write the proposal. Mm. It was 70 pages long.
Wow.
Whoa.
Overboard by
nature.
Is there
like potential content
yes.
inside of the proposal?
Yes, but it's narrative. So this is oral gotcha. History, right? But
right.
like I basically wrote it like a spec piece describing what the book would be. So there were quotes from the artist, but not original quotes. It was like, Albert Hammond Jr. has said this kind of thing
in
press.
Right,
will explore that. And the structure of it was pretty similar to, I mean, not exactly, but like not that dissimilar from what ended up being there. So I really did know what the benchmark was in terms of what I was promising to deliver. And then you take that proposal around to publishers and they read it and then they bid on it, ideally. And that's what happened here.
And you do it personally or this is like via...
An agent does it.
Yeah.
But the person who ended up buying the book is an editor I've known for a long time who does a lot of music books and is a friend. And she does Rob Sheffield's books and she did Kim Gordon's book and she's a big music fan and a kind of like she really wanted it and was also like the right woman for the job, I think. But there was, it was cool. There was like, when I first went to meet with some of the people who would need to be important to actually getting this done, like managers and stuff, there, it was interesting how there's sort of that rock thing of like, well, what do you think anyone will even care? Like, do you think anyone? And I was like, I do, in fact, because I've been to the publishing houses and they're like pretty psyched. But so Carrie, my editor,
or like book A&R guys as
yes,
shitty. It's like the same
kind of. There's a lot of like, yes, okay. It's important to. They call it managing expectations. Ugh. I call it being an asshole. But there's a sort of yeah. There's a kind of like it. You have no one wants to say that they think something will be big or important or that anyone will care, especially if they were involved in it. But so that's how it works. And then I sold the book, and then. There's like this really glowing period where you're like, right on. Like, yeah, that worked out. And then you're like, oh my God.
Like, I have to deliver this.
Yeah. And that's like to answer your question where I had a list of everyone I said would be in the book. So it wasn't hard to, I knew who my targets were, but then starting that, it's just so many interviews. It's so many interviews.
And when you do the interviews, is it, I was thinking about this as I was reading it. It's, do you have like a set of questions for each person, obviously catered towards the band, I'm thinking, but then you have to be able to form a narrative in your head. So I know that George R. R. Martin from Game of Thrones pays someone
Bayonne, New Jersey
to represent.
Get in there, Benny. Get right in there.
Like, throwing the dart. He pays someone to extrapolate lines and keep track of like all the characters. You know what I mean? Like J.K.
What?
Rowling. Oh, yeah, yeah. They have people because there's so many of them.
Call me. Call me, person who does this for Gamer.
Yeah. So like, this is all you?
Oh, yeah. Film, they call it, what is that, continuity editing?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, God.
Dying for one of those by the end, like dying. I did it all myself because I'm.
Lord.
I had a breakdown and moved upstate during this, right?
I
okay, let's talk about that.
Yeah,
that's fun. So
well, that's no accident. I mean, yes, it's very hard to answer your question. I did not. The interviews change based on how far along in the process you are. So at the very beginning, it's like completely open-ended, right? You're like, I know nothing yet. I have nothing on the record. So you just sit down and talk to people like you would anyone, you know? And of course, yeah, if you're interviewing, it's band specific or era specific, but short of that, I mean, the kind of points that I hit with almost everyone, I mostly started with what is your, this is how the book starts. What was your first memory of the idea of New York?
Mm.
Because that's the theme. Like, it's not a book about a particular band. There are plenty of books. It's already starting and I welcome it and understand it. But, you know, there are plenty of people already like, you really missed some steps about X, Y, or Z band. And it's like, right, because it's not a biography. Like, right. This is not a narrative of, it's not the complete history of the Strokes or the IAS or LCD Sound System. It's a story about New York and the idea of New York cool, basically, during this period of time and how that radiated and shaped culture, right? Mm. And these are the characters who formed that, who participated in shaping that idea. And that's why they're relevant. So I started with that for almost every interview. I asked about 9/11 for almost every interview. I asked about digital stuff for almost every interview. What was the first song you remember downloading? What was the first, if you're in a band, when was the first time a fan came up to you and asked you to sign a burn CD?
Because yeah, imagine every band involved in this book definitely fell on that time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
All the pre-Napster stuff.
Oh my God, big. So there were themes. Yeah. But then as you go along with the process, like, there are a bunch of people I went back to two or three times, and then it gets more narrow. It's sort of like, well, this person told me this, and what do you think about that? But no, at the beginning, it's kind of just like, I mean, that's why the transcribers who helped me work on this, and I had a bunch of interns at various points who are just saints. It's a big net. Like, you have to, you go in as broad spectrum as possible, knowing that the actual product is going to have to be as narrow as possible. And that's why you have breakdowns and move upstate.
What made you, this is what I found fascinating about the book, is because I've known your writing for a long time and you, mm-hmm. and I love your writing.
Thank you.
And when I read the intro,
yeah,
I was like, this is cool. Right on. Awesome. And then I'm reading the book and I'm like, oh, this is fascinating, but Lizzie's not writing anything.
Yeah.
But she put this story together. So it was,
yeah.
Weird is the wrong word. Different, because it was, you've created a story using someone else's words.
Yeah.
But they're not your words that I'm familiar with and enjoy. So like the intro, I loved the story about you and Nick Valencia like working together. I was like, well, this is her life. This makes sense to me.
Yeah.
And I see where she's going for it. But then I have to, I've been just trying to pair like, okay, there's a story here, but oh my God, how did she put that together?
Yeah, there was a lot of, thank you. For reading things that I've written in the past and present and hopefully future. Hopefully I haven't burned that out of you from
don't have another breakdown.
Yeah, no breakdowns. I'm done with that now.
Do you remember what broke it? What broke you?
I do, actually. Yeah. I have two basset hounds, Joni Mitchell and Jerry Orbach. And I would walk them in the West Village where I used to live. And at a certain point, it took like 5 years to write the book, basically. And the first 3 years were basically interviews. I mean, it's not as clean as this, but essentially like 3 years of talking to people and transcribing and sort of like pulling, like starting to do the patchwork of filing, making piles, basically. Like I would have edits of transcripts that were just bodies of quotes that I knew would go in the book, but I didn't know where yet, like a puzzle. And that was, it's sort of honing all that down. And then basically 2 years of attempting to assemble that. And when it hit the attempting to assemble that part, where it was no longer like, I'm really trying to do fewer and fewer interviews or only interviews that are targeted to specific thing. Like, I really need someone to say what Max Fish was. Like, come on. Like, let's, like, that's, because that's the spackling part where it's not, oral history is not hard, in my opinion, because you don't have good stuff. It's because you can't jump in. I mean, you can, some people do it, but I really wanted it to be like the bell goes off, rock star character, whatever, talking, the bell ends. I have not showed up. There's no interstitial break. It's all like audio. That's how I wanted it to go, which was not easy. And there was pressure to do it differently at various points. But basically I was really committed to doing that. So when I started to get to the point where I had to start really writing with this like clay that you'd sort of like collected in different piles, I could not talk to any other human beings. So I would get up.
Was that just because there wasn't even enough available brain space?
Like
at
voices
that point?
In your head, like an actual thing. I was like, I have 200 rock boys talking to me all the time. And Karen O. Thank you, Karen. You know, it was like very, it was very like dude heavy, and it was very like rock people heavy. And it was just very, and I have my actual job, which is like also doing versions of that. So basically there's,
you must have seen so many torn up pairs of expensive black jeans.
I did. And there was, And a lot of like, I mean, it's your job to go, you guys are doing it now. It's your job to go and like show up for someone else's story and to not, and to be able to actually do that with compassion and gratitude that they're willing to talk to you. And I, there was this one morning where I was walking the dogs. It was like whatever time of the day, morning time in the West Village. And three different people asked me where a Magnolia Bakery was. And I was like,
that might do it for me.
I'm done. Yeah. And Joni and Jerry are like the friendliest. Like Joni shows her belly to everyone who like walks near her, which at 9 o'clock in the morning in the West Village is everyone. So she's just like, hi, I love you. Oh my gosh, Magnolia Bakery is that way. I mean, Joni is like this sort of like the mascot of our block at the time. And so I was just like, I hate you. Like I hate all of you. I feel ill will towards you. I want you to be injured in some way. And that seemed like a bad place. And then, so then after that, I would like go upstairs.
Brad, you're laughing a lot at this.
Yeah, you're like, yeah, those Magnolia Bakery people are really.
I fucking hate them. You know what?
I'm laughing too, because I'd seriously move upstate about fucking 6 days a week if that feeling went to moving upstate.
Yeah, that happens
a lot.
Yeah.
Well, how did you, I'm curious, like, how did you deal with like shit talking and that, like, I feel like there's so much conflict in the book, especially with like the LCD group and like are you like, I feel like people are like, I fucking hated that person, or I dated this person, like
Jonathan fire eater stuff was killing
I mean, was it
oh,
hard
I'm so glad I want them to get
guts. I was like, that was so great, I didn't even listen to this band.
Yeah, that's what I'm hoping
into
for.
It.
Was it hard to like decide what to put in and not like bum people out, or do you have to not think about that so much?
Yeah,
or do you...
so I used a metric, which is a thing that I use in all my stories, which is like, is this actually relevant to the story? Mm. So a lot of people, I've been doing interviews for this, people are like, God, it's so gossipy. And I'm like, all right, you know, sure. If you think, I mean, I don't know what that means exactly, except I think that means that you think that this is like salacious, in which case, great. You know, I guess. I mean, I'm sorry. I'm not sure. All right. You know, it's gossipy. I think that the implication of that is supposed to be that gossip is bad, or there's some sort of that's a bad. Basically, for me, it's this is supposed to be a history. This is supposed to be an immersive, like, rendering of how it felt to be in this period of time in New York City, and like on the inside of a bunch of stories that ended up being important to people because of the music that was made. So the metric was, does this piece of salacious gossip fit, or whatever? Does this like dirty detail, does this detail that's like really fit into in a substantive way, shape the story of this band that I'm telling as they relate to New York City, which is the primary character. And I was pretty disciplined about that. So there is, I mean, believe it or not, there's like a ton of stuff that did not make the book that people would love to know.
That's how you sell book number two.
Yeah, that's right. Well, outtakes well coming done, soon to a theater. But no, I mean,
meet me in the men's bathroom.
I was like, Steven's gonna have a good line for that. Meet me in the other bathroom that you haven't seen yet. That's even grosser. I don't know. You know, so like there are. And even in that case, there's a couple like hookups or whatever that's just sort of like, I just need to not put this in here because it's just not, it's 50-50 whether this is really important to the story of this artist, and I'm going to choose not to put it in. But like the stuff, so all the stuff that people are saying is really scandalous, and I recognize that it's scandalous and I agree, but it's like, this is these scandals shaped how the band worked. So, you know, James Murphy's working style and his combative behavior and his, which is self-described sort of like I mean, yeah, like sort of rigorously attentive to detail to the point of pissing everyone off around him behavior. And people's responses to that is like 100% relevant to the story of that label and to the story of the band, or like drug use and strokes. And, you know, that's gotten a lot of attention because that excerpt ran in New York Magazine about like Ryan Adams' role and all of that. Like, there's a lot of other stories in all of these bands' worlds that weren't relevant to how the music got made or what happened next with X, Y, or Z artists that aren't, that are on the cutting room floor. But these are the ones that like affected what happened next. So that's why they're in.
So what was the deal with Carlos D? He was like the only person
that
didn't want to do it.
Yeah, he's the white whale of the book.
Did you?
God damn it.
No, but here's the thing.
All right, what's the thing?
So I interviewed Carlos D.
What?
At Lollapalooza.
What the fuck?
Years ago. And here's why.
How many years ago?
I don't fucking know. He dodged a bullet. And he started defending the Star Wars prequels, and like hackle came up on my neck, and I was like, "Listen, clown!" Like we literally like got into it, like about the prequels. I was like,
did
here's
you
why
fight
you're dumb.
Carlos D? Because that would be interesting.
No,
I'd
but
see
I did.
That.
But I do remember the website Carlos D gave me herpes.
Yes,
remember that?
I sure do.
That was the best.
Yeah, that's
website.
Not in there. That came up. I was like, I don't know why I didn't put that. I probably should have at the end of the day. Yes, that was a thing. It seemed mean. I was just like, I don't want to be mean to Carlos, even though like he's mean for not talking to me. I mean, I respect it. Look, here's the, when I was not getting other people who said no, who are now in it.
Like Dan Azzi.
Oh my God, amazing. Dan was a long holdout.
I'm sure.
But I, you know, I worked it and eventually he gave in.
He's got a lot to do. Yeah. He's busy.
Got a whale on those pecs.
Dan was at the gym for most of the time I was recording this, but I managed to get him. I met him at his gym. No, I did not, actually.
The only way I'll interview it, if you stand on a parallel stepmaster right next to him, it's the only time.
I got in great shape interviewing Dan Ozzie for this.
Dan's going to come back hard.
Dan's going to be so mad.
Yes, Dan, sorry. We love you. We're all big fans. That's how this has happened in the first place.
You have a gorgeous body.
You have a gorgeous body. Benny thinks you have a gorgeous body. Yeah, talks that was a lot me. About your pecs.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. So some people you weren't getting.
Some people I wasn't getting, and it was like, then I was more pissed at Carlos. Now that it's done and like basically everyone I wanted that I really needed came around at some point or another, it's sort of funny. Like now it seems like, I mean, also, this is the argument I made to many people, most of whom eventually seem to agree. But it's like, you're in the book. Like, you can't not, if you're Carlos, you're in the book. I mean, there's no not being in the book. You can't
you're
not
gonna
be
represented by other people.
Yeah. So don't you want to control your own story?
Exactly.
And I kind of, this is what I do respect about Carlos. Carlos was by far one of, if not the most, like, balls to the wall, committed to rock stardom, pompous, like, drug doing, celebrating the life, unabashedly party boy on this scene. And now he's not. And he's just sort of like as committed to not doing that as he was to doing it when he was doing it. And, you know, the argument of don't you want to represent your own story in this, you know, theoretical, semi-comprehensive history of your peers and moment in time in New York? And his answer is like, nah. I mean, there's a part of me that's like, okay.
I respect it.
Well, then all right. Good for you. And I do too. I mean, as the writer in this, I'm just still just like, oh.
Yeah, because he wanted it.
But you have to have a point where, as the writer, you have to let that go. We've had Lyle Pressler on a bunch, and he's told me that Michael Azarad like left him messages and he's like, and I just didn't call back.
Oh, my
you know what
God.
I mean? And at some point you have to go, well, okay.
That's it. And Carlos was, I mean, I talked to, you know, I've known him over the years and I emailed with him about this and it's not like he didn't write me back. He was just like, no, thank you. And I was with various levels of persistent at various periods of time. And eventually he was just like, I really need you to stop emailing me. But in a nice way, I mean, but just sort of like, I think he said, let's consider the matter closed or something very Carlos-y
very
like that.
I'm watching episode one again because that's what kids like in sci-fi, trade embargoes.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
What are you talking about Star Wars again?
Yeah,
maybe.
Star Wars.
Yeah. Maybe.
I can't.
Are you
talking
about trade embargoes in Star Wars, Steven?
Yeah. You are.
Again. It's the first time, won't be the last.
It always wind up here.
We'll revisit this later in the show, I would imagine.
We have a segment here called Mystery Friend.
Yeah, Mystery Friend.
What's
Mystery
Friend?
You get a question from a Mystery Friend.
Is it Dan Ozzie? Just say it's
Dan. It's not Dan
Ozzie. Let's roll it out right now.
Dan actually kind of Carlos D'd me on this and said no. I was like, the question for Lizzie. He's like, nah.
He cold-called Mystery Friend?
Not in, oh my God, I'm so offended. Not in like a mean way, no. Like I don't care, but he was like, I don't want to do it.
Why?
Wow.
Oh, Dan.
I want to see this
Lizzie-Dan meeting, the next one that happens. Goodness gracious.
Here's the question.
There's going to be a reckoning, and now that you've told me that, he's in trouble.
Here's the question, and who is it?
Don't punch him in the stomach. You'll hurt yourself. You'll hurt your hand. Goodness.
Ask Lizzie if she's kept in touch or looked up any of the schoolboys she used to teach.
Oh, my God.
Who do you think it is?
So you have to answer the question, and then you have to guess which friend of yours asked this question.
And it wasn't me, even though it made me remember that I spoke at that school with
Jared Gorbel. Well, can you answer first? What
is this
with school boys?
Do you remember that?
No? Okay. Wait, what's the first thing I have to say? You have to give me structure. Wait, so I'm saying, I'm answering this question?
Yeah. You're answering this question. Have you kept in touch or looked up any of the schoolboys you used to teach?
It's got to be Sarah.
It's Sarah.
Okay.
Ding, ding, ding.
Yes, it is. It's Sarah. Okay, cute. Yes, that sounds like Sarah. Okay,
podcast
so,
guest and friend, Sarah
podcast, Litton. Yeah, exactly.
Sarah Litton, right.
Phew. Okay. No, but I do, like, I'm Facebook friends with, like, a couple of their moms, and then so period. So I used to teach, okay.
Yes, unpack it.
Right, so
it's a safe place,
I was
Lizzie.
Really good at school. I went to, like, lots of school, and I liked being in school, and I thought that I was going to be, like, a professional person, not, like, a rock journalist. Like, I thought I would have, like, a normal job.
She just totally dogged on Jonah's career.
Yeah, Jonah, on the other hand, we all knew what Jonah was destined for, which is this illustrious career.
Well, I know these two are part of some Illuminati.
Jonah and I are controlling the world.
Yeah. Well, you guys, we can't get into that here. I think you know that
that's
uncool.
You're in league with the German journalists of the world.
God, I wish. German journalists, like, won't talk to American journalists right now. They're like, we're the leaders of the free world right now. Thanks. Can you just not? Just please.
So you're learning, you're thinking you're going to be a teacher.
Yeah, I was the co-chair of the pre-law society in college. Like, I thought I would be a lawyer. I kept trying to take the LSAT, and I kept being like, not this weekend. Like, whatever. So I basically just didn't think that it was a thing that you could do. Which is understandable because it's kind of not. Like, it remains not really a job, even now. But so when I graduated from college, I got a job teaching second grade at an all-boys school on the Upper East Side called the Buckley School. And they all wore blazers, and it was very, it's a very...
rich motherfuckers.
It's a very, like, traditional... It's the Upper East Side. They wear blazers. Yeah. They're eight, you know, like even the five-year-olds wear blazers. And it was actually awesome. Like, I'm still in touch with the other teacher that I taught with, and I did it for 2 years. And in between that, I interned at Spin for the first time. So, like, it coincided with the period of my life where I was partying the most. So it was really a weird time. Like, it basically had two time zones. I would leave school and I would go, like, after dismissal, I would leave and I would go home to my apartment that I shared with Sarah Litton, mystery guest. And I would sleep for a couple of hours, and then we would go out to dinner or whatever. Like, someone would eat some food at some point, but mostly it was like we would just go to bars, and then I would be out until 2 or 3 or later in the morning, and I would sleep for a couple of hours, and then I would get on the subway at 6:30 and go up to the Upper East Side and teach, and then come down and do it again. And so that was my life. And in the summer, I interned, and it was awesome. It was like a good entry point. It was a way to...
Sounds cool.
It was great. But the other day, one of my... It's funny she says this, because maybe she knows this, in which case that's very sneaky, Sarah. the other day, one of my old students either liked something of mine on Instagram or somehow I saw his name, and I was like, I know that name. And then I looked at his profile, and he's a drummer, and he has a band, and he's an adult, which is really alarming.
How old are these kids now?
So they're like...
The Buckley School with these blazers, they could be like fucking up the world by now.
And now, they're like late college or out of like they're like 21, 22 years
half
old.
Of them are living in Dubai, like being consultants.
Well, this one is like a drummer in a band. Right, yeah.
That's why he liked an Instagram. It's like, wait, I know someone.
I don't think so. I think he left Buckley fairly soon after that because they kept Buckley in touch with some people. Yeah, he's a Buckley drummer. Buckley exactly. And now he's a drummer.
Hey.
Okay.
Hey, you got to drop out of school to do it. That's how it works.
Yeah. Listen up, kids. Yeah. Listen up, kids. Yeah.
Drop out of many colleges, deliver pizzas, and it might happen
for
you.
It might happen
for you. But probably not.
But probably not. So, enjoy that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I want to switch gears a touch.
Okay.
I saw a piece you did for Elle.
Uh-huh.
Where you unmasked to someone like me this, like, female Illuminati who's, like, controlling shit. Which is pretty cool, by the way. I'm like into it, but
yeah.
Something, and I assume you're behind this comment because it was a blow quote.
Okay.
And you said,
what's the comment?
Being a girl is no longer politically neutral.
Ah,
yeah. Your identity, whether you like it or not, is now political.
That is not my quote, but I love the idea that it would be. I certainly agree with it.
I figured since it was a blow quote, you endorsed it. But even though you probably don't, can you pull your own blow quotes?
No.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Not classy. I wouldn't do that.
Who's gangster enough to pull their own blow quotes? Are there people?
Beyonce?
Yeah.
I think that's it. That's okay. The whole list. Beyonce. Yeah. I mean, I think, yeah, that piece was crazy. This is the story that I wrote about the wing and going to the Women's March, which was nuts. And amazing. And I mean, basically, that area of thought is what I'm writing the most about right now. Like, this book is coming out and it's awesome. I'm so into it. I'm also really, like, today there's an excerpt on Elle.com about Karen O's side of the story. That's like the next excerpt that we did. And Karen O's on the cover. And I mean, it's unfortunate that there aren't more women in the book. I wanted there to be. It's, you can't like make the scene different than it was. But one of the things that was really important when we first sat down and started promoting the book was I want this to not be promoted just to like dude rock sites, like, or rock proper. I mean, this is not a book for guys. It's a book for, I mean, the introduction is my story and my relationship with New York City, and that myth is universal. And it was really important to me to the extent that you can, to help present this story as like gender neutral. Like, if there should be a bunch of artists out there, young artists who want to be like the people in this book, and whether they're male or female or identify as whatever they identify, they should be able to see all of the characters that are sort of like admirable and exciting in the book as potential role models. That's how I felt. Like, I felt like Joe Strummer and Patti Smith and like Joan Didion were all teaching me how to be me. And that only later was it sort of like, oh, wait, I guess I can't be Joe Strummer. You know, only from sort of social interaction was I aware that that was like basically not allowed because, you know, you're a girl. So like, sit down. Mm.
There's a lot of that in the book that I thought it was very even keeled. What fascinated me was that it wasn't a book about a bunch of white dudes. Which, mind you,
I'm glad
we run
you
to
think
that with
that.
The podcast.
I mean,
well, like Brad and I were talking about, like the TV on the radio guys.
Yeah, they're the best, aren't
you know
they?
What
the
mean?
Best.
They're the greatest.
Yeah.
And to this day, still one of my favorite bands.
They're amazing. And I did not know them at all. There's a couple people in the book that were just like total, you know, sort of, I can't believe you're real gems. Like, I had an interview for whatever reason. I just didn't know them. I didn't know the DFA guy. I didn't know the TV on the radio guys. And they're just awesome. Like, all of them that I spoke to. And yeah, I'm glad you think, because it's hard. I mean, it is like, these are white guys. These are like relatively privileged for the most part. It's hard to respect the story and also tell it correctly and also be open to trying to present it in a way that feels universal. But I just knew you have to go to what's personal to you. And I felt very, I mean, I've one of the stories that I considered putting in the introduction was about being in college when So I knew, as you mentioned, but for those who would never know this, and why would you? Like, I started coming to New York when I was in college in Philadelphia, and I worked in a restaurant with Nick, who was in the Strokes. And so I knew, like, kind of my entry point to some of these bands were, like, my friend Nick who cheated off of me in wine tests at our restaurant. Like, that was Nick. It was like the first sort of urban kid that I knew who's just kind of like, hey, I'm like, look, this girl's kind of like, she's like a smart girl. I'm going to like cheat off of her paper and then we'll go like smoke cigarettes after this and it'll be fun. Like,
something that was tells me you've been cheated off your entire life.
Well,
when it comes to academics.
Yes, I guess so. Maybe. No, I mean, I don't know. I didn't care. That's fair part enough. Of the problem, fair you know? Enough. Oh God.
It's okay.
That's for a different part of this conversation when
Listen,
it gets
Lizzie,
real
you're
deep.
Doing fine.
Yeah. Really?
You really are.
Sure?
I mean, you're doing good.
I just, I don't like, know. Well, like, did I get an A yet? Oh God.
You got it. You always get an A here.
Oh,
I'm
oh,
going off track.
I'm so glad I'm just going to stay. I'll just move
yeah,
in.
Yeah, but it's 94 to 100 is an A. It's
well, very A minus oh if you have God. Kids. Oh my Jonah's God. Not into it.
Heart palpitations. Heart palpitations.
Sidebar. That was my goddamn high school. Just want to say
that mine too.
94 to 100. Yeah, yeah. Fuck those
94
people.
To 90 to 94 was an A minus.
Oh, that was straight up B. You were fucked.
Okay. So, all right. So now I understand you better.
I didn't touch the 90s very often.
Legit.
Then he's
legit.
Like, what even is like, this what? Realm of like whatever?
Goodness gracious. I don't know.
Yeah.
This.
What even is that category? Oh my God. Amazing.
It's funny you brought up like the like privileged kid thing. Cause like it was one thing that I actually enjoyed about your book that opened up that world more to me. It's because people like me, it was funny listening to gentrification stuff in this book.
Yeah.
Because to them, they were kind of mentioning it was happening while they were living there. And to people like me, it uh-huh. happened before they got there.
Uh-huh.
You know what I mean?
That's
like
interesting.
The Williamsburg sure. they went to,
yeah.
this is not fucking Williamsburg. Even the one that they went to
yeah.
wasn't Williamsburg. So
what Williamsburg did you remember?
The one that my mom talked about yeah. in 1945 yeah, with yeah, a bunch yeah. of fucking Jews and, you know, like Italians and
hanging out.
And
yeah.
the concept that you would even go to Brooklyn to live when you had the money to live in Manhattan was insane
yeah.
to the older people in Brooklyn and stuff. So I thought it was interesting from my perspective because when The Strokes came out, we were like, oh, fucking rich kids, fuck them.
Sure.
You know what I mean? Like, they don't even deserve it because they didn't have to grind. They didn't have to do this. So I actually enjoyed reading parts of that book where I'm like, you know what? I'm a fucking dick. Like, like
that
so
was my favorite part of the
it's
book.
It's so self-righteous, like, to be like, they didn't work at all. They sat in their fucking ivory tower and went straight to the top.
Yeah.
So I enjoyed that part of the book. I appreciate
well,
it.
Well, good. Yeah, I think that one of the things that's come up when I've been talking about this is I think there's a big difference, and it's relevant to the current cultural climate. There's a difference between privilege and like cultural sophistication. I mean, there's a difference between cultural sophistication and money.
Mm.
So those guys were privileged in that they went to private schools. Someone was figuring out how to get them there. Even if it's, I don't know them well enough to know the like financial details of sure. whatever. And they're one example. I mean, we're also talking about like Vampire Weekend. They all met a I mean, there's a lot of different, the Yaya Yaz kids all went to art school, liberal mm-hmm. art school. I mean, there's people with of privilege, undeniable privilege in this story. A lot of them. But privilege and money, at least back then, weren't the same thing. I mean, I think that's changing in America, which is really terrifying. But I don't know how Nick got himself to private school, but I know that he needed to have a job in order to have any money to do anything that he wanted to do. And that he didn't, you know, this, it wasn't like I went to Penn and, you know, Ivanka Trump was there when I was at Penn. And like, this was not some, there were a lot of kids with like that, like
didn't
actual.
Didn't Donnie go to Wharton too?
Yeah.
Are you feeling good
and
about that?
You know who went. I
Vanessa
am not,
Bayer also went
I
to
am
Penn.
Not.
Oh,
so we're evening it out.
Yeah, that's good.
It's like we've got Vanessa on yeah. this side. And
Whitney Cummings.
Yeah, Whitney. Yeah, so we've got some folks. Yeah, yeah, exactly. But basically, like, there were real.
Ted Kaczynski. There's that was Harvard.
There's this idea that the Strokes guys or anyone else like that were rolling through the Lower East Side just like by. I don't know what people think they did. Maybe like. I don't know what people think money gets you, but nobody can buy success on that level in New York. You can't, you have to, the word is grind, like sure. you have to grind. So I don't think it's fair to say, I don't subscribe to the idea that like, that's such bullshit and those guys didn't have anything going for them and they were just like working class kids. They obviously were not working class kids. And I love the story in the book where they go to England and they're bitching about the food. And it's like, there's no sushi here. You know, it's like, that's what people mean. It's this sort of idea. But I see that as cultural privilege and access to New York City and access, a sense of like ownership of art, of an ability to sort of to explore and educate yourself from what the city offers you and maybe what your parental background offered you, rather than like money in your pocket. Because those guys did not have money. I mean, when I was rolling around with them when we were all kids, like, they didn't, that's not what they were like. And this was the story I was going to tell about the feminism piece too. Like, there's also this thing about how those dudes were all, you know, there was models everywhere and it was just this like party band and hot girls everywhere. When I was in college, I went to a show that they played. It was after they broke in the UK, and there was this guy that my friend Nikki, that I used to go to these shows with all the time, was friends with. Like, she knew him. He was in her sort of, like, she knew him. We kind of knew him. And he was British, and he knew about the Strokes. And he was like, this was before they broke in America, that kind of 6 month period when England knew about them, but America didn't really. And I knew them because it was my friend Nick's band, and I didn't really know they had blown up or anything. But this guy was like, what? You guys are going to that show? And I was like, yeah, whatever. And Nikki was like, we're not going with him. Like, I don't like him. And I was like, okay. Not really sure what that's about. And I made her tell me what it was. And this guy would routine called me behind my back, Nikki's fat friend. Like, this is this Strokes fan, this British Strokes fan. And Nikki, of course, hated him because he said that. And we went to the show, and she told me this, and I was like, oh, I guess that guy's kind of a dick. Interesting. So we go to the show, and we're hanging out, and like, it was in those early years before they had it, where they were still sort of realizing that they were starting to have some cultural power. And Nick comes bounding out of the backstage area and is like, because he knew we were there, and he's like, beckons us across the floor and is like, he called me Elizabeth, like, Elizabeth, Nikki, like, come on over. And this guy was standing there and like saw this happen and sort of saw, I really remember feeling that very specifically. Like, this guy was a person of a position of sort of, you know, hierarchical power within this like kind of elite moneyed pen world. Like, you know, he was a rich kid from London, and he was in Wharton, I'm sure. I mean, it was like that world. There was a lot of that there. Mm-hmm. And here were these supposed sort of judgy, pretentious, rich, modelizing kids, like, who were, according to him, welcoming essentially the outsiders in, like, from across the hallway into the VIP room they were so excited about. And that's one thing, you know, having known those guys back then, and also just the scene itself, it's not really about the Strokes. Like, people, it's so easy to remember, to think now that all these people are so cool, because they are. Like, Karen O is so cool, and like, Julian is cool. These people are cool. But music starts because you, or New York starts, the idea of New York, music itself starts from feeling like you don't have a place. Sure. And you want to make a connection, and you don't know how to do that. These are outsiders. Like, in whether you see that from your position or not, that's how it felt. And I always think about that moment when people are like, those guys are such dicks, you know, or those guys are such, I mean, I think about the Moldy Peaches. I think about myself as someone that someone like that would cast as like not worthy of his attention. And I think about like what it feels like for young women to be, that was, go find your rock friends, you know? And I wanted this book to kind of feed into that feeling a little bit as well, because it was definitely a resource for me.
I think it's so interesting because I had the same kind of idea as Benny.
Really?
Like, I felt like, well, just coming up in punk, I felt like it was so, I didn't listen to a lot of these bands, which is, I think the book is so interesting.
Good.
I wasn't invested in any of the bands so much, but I thought it was, I think I was like more into like bands, like nerdy guys that looked like me that didn't get girls, that sang about not getting girls.
Right.
You know
and
what
the
I
Strokes
mean?
Got that lots so much, of girls. Like, yes. let's not feel too sorry for, I'm not saying, fair enough. Yes.
I liked how you threw in Fisher Spooner.
Oh my God.
Who I remember seeing in LA in like an abandoned subway warehouse.
Really?
And it was like a free show. Sponsored by Levi, of all weird places.
That sounds right.
And I was like, I haven't thought about this band in years. Not a band. But it was this like
not
performance
a band.
Art thing that every once in a while I'll still think about how insanely cool that was.
Was it cool? Was it the show, so to speak,
it was
good?
So cool. I thought it was cool. And I have a very specific
okay.
degree in experimental theater, like, you know, like they
and
did
you
this.
Talk about fucking Star Wars a lot.
I'm not. I do. I'm a dork. Force Awakens is kitschy. I'm sorry. Anyway.
Oh my god.
So what? The Jedi, they lost after Jedi, and now it's still shit.
Oh my god. So, this is so funny.
But like, I remember seeing the show, and the book brought that back for me, because what I remember was, and I can't remember if it was Fisher or Spooner, but one of them was pretending to be the stage manager and the other one was pretending to be the rock star. And purposely, I remember it, the music skipped. They had to start over, which I learned from the book was intentional, which makes me like them more. And two, they had hired all these dancers. So whoever was the stage manager wearing a Cats sweatshirt, Broadway the Cats, periodically, while the dancers were dancing, he would jump into the routine at exactly the right time and dance with them. And it was either just me or the whole crowd going, this is amazing.
Yeah.
This is, and then they sold jeans afterwards.
Yeah, totally. Right. And we're talking like 2000 or something. Yes. So they're, that's a great example. I mean, I love those guys. They're so smart and they're so they're so like pop culturally literate that you're basically like when I was interviewing them, I was like, maybe you should write this. Like, I don't know if I think you've got it. Like the whole story, but they were really relevant because it's so early. Like, this whole idea that everything is, because everything is is image conscious, it's that even the idea of being a band is in and of itself sort of high concept if everyone's being watched all the time. Like, you can't have, which is a creepy thing, but back then seemed sort of avant-garde to even present, and now seems like absolutely normal and the standard that any band is forming under. They really saw that early. Like, there's this line in the book where Casey is talking about how, you know, people thought they were disgusting for whatever, for presenting themselves as for indicating that image is as important as anything else that they're doing. Like, what it looks like has to match very much what it sounds like or whatever. And now it's like we live in a Kardashian world where this is 100% what everyone's doing all the time. But the real reason those guys are so relevant, at least to my story, is, I mean, I think they're fascinating, but is because of the effect they had on DFA. Because they pissed James off. Like, James is just like, wait a second, they got how much money to do what?
Yes.
And it was sort of that sense of, I mean, they deserve their own book. Like, they've done their own stuff. They're so interesting. But in terms of like why they belong to the story about New York music during that period of time, it's they belong, and they belong because of how they animated other people around them to kind of react against or in response to what they were doing and sort of put the pedal to the metal. Like, they got so much money. They made so much money.
I felt the same way about, like, referencing, again, David Holmes, who I hadn't thought about in years. And I paid money to hear him DJ one time. And again, for me, it was entertaining. I don't think other people were entertained, because $15 to go hear him play at the fucking, oh God.
Yeah, where?
It's on Cahuenga. It was a shitty little bar. It's one of the bars they reference in Swingers on one of the answer machines.
The Dresden?
No, they wouldn't play there. But I used to live near there. But wasn't a good luck bar. Yeah. Three Kings. No, what the fuck was it called? Three Clubs. It's three clubs.
That's where I went at my 21st birthday.
There it is.
See? Wow. Was David Holmes DJ? Anyway.
I don't think so.
You wouldn't know, though, would you?
I probably wouldn't know.
Here's what David Holmes did. He DJed nothing but Public Enemy, which all it did was make me laugh myself sick.
That sounds like
the whole evening. And all these dumb rave kids I was hanging with were so angry. He wasn't doing anything off like Lex. It was Let's Get Killed. It was right before the Bow Down record.
It's okay.
Like, key Ocean's 11, David Holmes. And all he did was spin Public Enemy, and all I did was cackle the whole time.
Awesome. Were people just pissed?
People were just so mad.
That's awesome.
He likes to piss people off,
that guy. I love these people. They're such great rock characters. The DFA people were so... And all those Brits, I mean, they just wanted to come to... They like Tim Goldsworthy, James, like Phil Mossman. These people, they were like, they're proper English, like rock raconteurs. Like, they are those characters. Well, not English in certain cases. David would kill me. But like, there's that sense of sort of I love in the UK the balance between like repression and then mania. Like they're just, I used to IM with a British friend of mine who's an A&R, and he's one of the dirtiest people I know, and he would get all like just saying absurd shit, and then I would just go silent for a second, and it would take like 45 seconds, and then it's like, oh my God, I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. I didn't mean it. Please forgive me forever. And that balance of the culture where it's sort of just, they are the most extreme people and the most sort of like polite and decorous and whatever. And I think those guys' sense of New York shaped, I mean, it invented DFA. Like James then ran with it. But he says, he's like, those guys coming here, those guys, they wanted to live where Public Enemy had lived. One of my favorite quotes is when Tim Goldsworthy is talking about how they land and they are jet lagged on their first morning in New York City, and they're ready to be here where, like, you know, they want to see like silver apples, like liquid, like Public Enemy. They want to see the streets of New York, and they're hoping that someone will pull a gun on them, like on their first walk out, and they're in the West Village. And it's the 90s, so like still, but like they're, it's no, and they're like, oh my God, everyone is so polite. We're like, can we get a cup of coffee? And people are like, well, what kind of coffee would you like? And down the block, there's this, and down the block. And they're like, absolutely not. We're going to have to.
The Warriors.
They were expecting the Warriors.
Yeah.
And that's like, I think that there's something about that cultural exchange where it's like their view of their New York City, which isn't theirs, makes you want to live up to, like, it certainly made the Americans they ended up meeting want to kind of like get on board with creating something that wild and decadent and dangerous feeling, which was certainly not there.
How many of these people did you have to, that had you not met, and how many people had gone to shows and seen and were friends and acquaintances?
Yeah. Maybe half and half.
Okay.
Yeah. Like Strokes, Yeah, Interpol, knew them all a little bit. DFA, TV on the Radio, Vampire Week, all the Brooklyn bands, like, didn't know them at all.
What about, I mean, to me, you know, talking about the Strokes so much, I mean, they kind of come off in a lot of ways as the underdogs in this book. I mean, sort of their relationship with Kings of Leon and how
they got
so big, and then this sort of idea that Room on Fire came out and the label wasn't really behind it, even though it was such a great record.
Totally.
I mean, it's interesting because I guess like they're so associated with that scene, you view them as like the biggest thing, but I guess on a commercial level, they really weren't.
Mm. Yeah, it's weird because, you know, when the excerpt ran in New York too, it was like their first out of the gate once again, and there was sort of like a lot of, I don't know, the British magazines were cannibalizing those quotes and launching their own media sort of bits in the UK and beyond. And it was sort of like, oh my God, this is hilarious. This is happening again. Like, the book is not actually just about like the Strokes or about this period of time, but they, once again, like, I didn't tell New York what to pick. That's what they picked. And once again, it's like, for whatever reason, this band is just kind of first, like, they're just kind of the lightning rod for this world, and there, that comes with a lot of pluses and it comes with some minuses. And I think, you know, the thing that a lot of bands that were directly influenced by that band, whether you're talking about creative influence, they'll just say, like, this modern age EP changed how I wrote my songs. Like Brandon Flower says that, or Kings of Leon are just like, yeah, we heard that and we were like, okay, we have our plan now. Like, here's it's go time. But also commercially, I mean, it really is hard to remember this. It seems crazy, but there were not supposed to be rock bands around. There were just not. I mean, the scene where I think it's David Gottlieb talks about, who's an industry guy at RCA at the time, talks about going to see the Strokes for the first time and saying, you know, anyone who signs this band is stupid. And it's like, well, why? It's because the paradigm that we have basically invested in for the next blah, blah, blah quarters, which is how we all know record business, you know, record labels actually operate. This is going to destroy that. Like, this is, if we help make this successful,
are you
going to
ruin
it? It ruins our bottom line right now. This isn't good for business, weirdly, because it's not what we planned on. And I think it's important to remember, I'm glad that it comes off that way, the way you're saying, because I think the Strokes feel like this huge force and they were so galvanizing, and they're but they are kind of underground in that sense. They have not, their sales are not on par with a lot of the artists that they've influenced. I mean, they can tour, and I don't know, it's not like I'm on the inside of their economic reality. I'm sure they're doing fine, and I have no idea what they actually make, but like, the Kings of Leon are fucking giant rock stars, and their giant rock stars, or the Killers are giant rock stars on a level that the Strokes didn't reach. And there are a lot of reasons why, or haven't reached yet, however you want to phrase it. But I don't know why. I just know that that's true. And I think that it's interesting. And one of the things that I think is interesting about it is just when you think about like underground versus mainstream, one of the things that came up when I was reporting this and trying to kind of parse that question was intention. Like when Caleb and Nathan from Kings of Leon sat down to write songs, even before they knew any of this would be possible before the Strokes, it was like they wanted, you can, they had that like mainstream intention. It was like, we want to be fucking huge. Like, how do we get there? Even if it was like they were still in Nashville and there's no way that's going to happen. That was the sort of sense of yourself and the hunger and the idea of it. Brandon Flowers too. Julian, I mean, people will probably give me shit for saying this, and I don't know him, I'm not in his head, but like Nick says it in the book too, and you know, they wanted to be guided by voices.
Yeah, they fucking did. That's where I first saw the Strokes.
They did, you know,
watching Guided by Voices. Yes, I saw the Strokes, and someone's like, and Pollard yells, and the Strokes are here.
Yeah.
And was like,
yeah.
And I remember then they made that video.
Yes.
The Family Feud video. And yes, they pull in Guided by Voices to, yes, do it. They played Fuse 1,000 years ago.
Yeah.
And it was like a commercial edit. And they start playing a salty salute. And I remember just singing, going, it's on the satellite. Yeah, and totally. I'm singing along. And fucking Fab looks over and goes, points at me. And I was like, yeah, dude, Guided by Voices, of course.
He's like, you're one of us. Like,
yeah. Someone who's going to make 1,000 records and write 4 good songs.
Do you think that, like,
that was the goal?
That maybe at some point in their career, like, that idea that that was not their intention, is, did they do anything along the way in your estimation that shot themselves in the foot because there wasn't, right, their intention?
Sure.
So she would, yeah, rather they be like Pavement, and now we're going to argue again.
I would. I mean, God, Pavement are just my favorite band ever. Yeah, all right. I can feel the wall between us now.
It's happened before.
I mean, it makes perfect sense.
There's a palpable tension between Lizzie and Steven.
See, there's dog people and cat people.
That's right. And I'm a dog person.
And there's Bob people and Steve people. There's two people.
So, do you think they made like any decisions along the way that like...
I think when you're 22, I mean, you know more about this, you, Benny, than I would. But I would say, having talked to them, Fab says this really well, like at a certain point. I mean, obviously it's retrospective when he's saying this, but he's like, oh, you know, almost like raising his hand. And another thing, we were children, you know, right, quick note, we were children.
Sure.
I mean, so in 2001, those guys were like, Nick would have been like 20.
Right.
21 years old, you know, and the other, he's young, maybe the young, I mean, Julian's maybe a year or two older. I mean, they're all like, that's the age. So like, there's this idea that gets thrown around that this sort of the age in which you become famous is the age at which you're arrested, you know, like that's it. So if you get to be 28 and you become, that's your biggest success, and then that's what you have to live up to, then you're 28. That's sort of your cultural age. If you're 20, you're 20. And I'm not saying, I don't think that's exact. I think those guys are all like, are adult humans now, and we're not adult humans then.
Sure.
But I think this idea that, in other words, to answer your question would require a sense of ownership of like what a mistake is. Like that you're sitting there going, well, you know, what I'm thinking right here is like, there's three paths, and should we work with Gordon Raphael on the third record because it's been so successful on the first two? Or should we, I mean, I think they felt, or should we not? Because, you know, it's important to evolve, and like, we tried to evolve and it didn't work last time, and now people are giving us shit, and like, we don't know that in 5 years people are going to be saying our first two records are classic, because right now they're saying our second record isn't enough of a departure from the first. I mean, what you just, and you're 25,
right,
or 24 years old when all that's going on, and you've basically been on the road drunk for 4 years. And again, it's like, it's so easy when you're in this conversation to be like, woe is me. Like, oh, I'm so sorry. You became a famous rock star. And then you had to deal with what rock stars have to deal with, which is this. And it's like, it's not, I'm not saying I feel sorry for any of these people. I don't feel sorry. It's not just the Strokes either. It's Interpol. It's all these bands had to deal with relatively unexpected, relatively overnight success with, you know, substances flowing and like not a lot of experience on their side. So, and some did handled it better than others. But I mean, yeah, I think it's easy to backseat drive and say it, the Strokes' third record was a turning point. Like their sound started to change or whatever that means. But I also can imagine myself sitting here having this conversation and saying, you know, what really went wrong is the Strokes never tried to change their sound. And now they're just, you know, they just kind of, it's always going to be compared to Is This It? And it's never, they never really tried to evolve, and you have to evolve. I mean, I don't know.
Who knows?
You just
define the exact problem and solution with rock journalism.
What, that you can always take an angle that's correct?
Yeah, that you're going to be like, well, they didn't go this way because they could have done that.
Well, yeah, and A&R guys, which is the same thing. Like, they'll, you could put 50 A&R guys in this room and they'll tell you exactly what went wrong, apparently. Now.
Yeah.
Now
they'll
tell you
that
exactly
they know,
what happened.
Right.
Yeah.
I think it's like any, this is now we're really getting, this is like going to be an On Being episode or something. But it's like bands stop, like any relationship, outside influences, you stop listening to each other, you stop actually finding the time to hear the music that you're making and figure out if you're enjoying making it. And that is bad.
Sure.
You know? Like, and every band in this story has a moment like that.
Yeah.
TV on the radio, I remember.
They're different.
That's a whole different thing.
That's a whole different thing. Cause, I mean, we had, who's the animator we had on? Jonah, a guy who actually worked with
Tunde?
Yeah, they worked together. They were interns. I can't remember, but I remember like hearing a story from him. Brad and I know their manager, and and like they don't, they'll like, they hate touring.
Oh,
like,
yeah.
They'll talk about it. You know what I mean? Hate touring, which is kind of be, it's like, that's just got to be hard to be in a band, to tour.
They're
and all
not
that.
A normal band, those guys. They're, and that's part of why they've lasted, which is maybe your point.
I guess. Yeah. It's because that's it. Because they seem to not have gotten locked in anything. And I was so thrilled to see them in your book because they seem to be an anomaly.
They're totally
some bands are very sure of themselves at like a young age. And I feel like.
Well, they were older too.
Right.
Yeah, right.
Oh,
okay.
That might, yeah, okay.
I feel
that's
like that.
That's the thing.
Yeah.
It's really interesting that you were saying it seems so obvious now that like Kings of Leon and
Killers
were writing for arenas. And it makes it. It's obvious,
yes, exactly.
Right? In retrospect, it's totally obvious. But like, you got to realize, like, in the Strokes and TV on the radio, they definitely all come out of the same little playground where that wasn't a possibility.
Yes,
you got to
exactly.
realize it was two decades of nobody came out of New York and got big. There was no scene.
And to say
signed.
You want to be guided by voices was already kind of brazen. I mean, you know, not only because guided by voices are fucking awesome, but because to play guitar rock and roll was like, oh.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, you got, I mean, it's just impossible. I mean, like Mark Ronson talks about this in the book too, which I love, about like the idea that you would DJ a rock song next to a hip hop song in 2001 was like, what are you doing?
Yeah.
Like this was not, I mean, we live in this culture that has completely shifted in terms of sort of multi-genre merging, essentially over a 10-year period, which is part of why I wanted to write this book, because these bands' stories sync up with these huge tectonic changes in all these other areas of our culture. And following them reveals that. But that was crazy. So, like, you know, the idea that the idea that you would be, Jack White is a great, this is to answer your thing about why TV on the radio, what is it that sheltered certain people from some of these problems and not others? Part of it is youth, and part of it is just chance. Like I said, the Strokes were first. They just were first, and that means you're first. That means you're going first. All the bad stuff is coming. All the good stuff is coming. The highs, the lows, nobody, and everyone behind you is going, this is possible because you did it. So like, I know that I can play Saturday Night Live. Whereas like a band in New York City wouldn't have thought they could do that before the Strokes did it. But it's also this age thing. Like Jack White, James Murphy, the you know, Dave Siddick, Tunde, the guys from TV on the Radio, they're all like to varying degree, like 5 years older even. I mean, in James Murphy's case, like 10 years older. James Murphy, importantly, really importantly, was a failed indie rock musician when DFA started. Mm. He had been touring in the sort of like classic American underground East Coast indie scene, wearing a wallet chain, which is one of the details that I love, with his apparently very long and fabulous hair, which like a lot of people seem to want to talk about, which amused me. They're like, he had this hair. You're like, okay.
What was
awesome?
What was so special about this mane?
I wish I'd seen it. It's legendary. You know, it's curious. Not, I don't know. It was quite flowing and made an impression on lots of indie rock boys in the 90s. I don't know. But, you know, he didn't think, and Jack had this too, he thought it was over. And Dave talks about this too. Siddick, like, had been playing in bands in Baltimore and been in that world and then was like, okay, that's over. I guess his brother lived in New York. Like, he basically, it's like all those guys had a sense of the life I was trying for in one way or another. And also Franz Ferdinand, Alex Kapranos talks about this. Like, the thing I was trying to do with music, it's not as neat with Jack because he was always like striving. But basically, I do not expect to get any attention for my music ever.
Right.
And I've tried. And I'm old now in rock standards. Like, I'm through most of my 20s and like it's over for me. So I might as well do whatever I want. But they also came with a sort of backlog of the kind of the weathering that that experience gives you against what's coming to you. That's the best way. Like, if I could recommend a way to be a famous rock star, like, first fail for 10 years.
That's, yeah, that's exactly it. That's the real line, man. It's almost that way where, like,
fail first, you know?
Where if you, like, you know, walk into a bar and you don't care what the opposite sex is going to say one way or the other, you're just into asking the question, like, you're probably going to get him. You know, like, and it
Benny
does,
is speaking from personal experience.
Oh, yeah. And it does. It works the same way in music. It's an interesting thing I hear about all the time with people. You know, I'll talk to some of my friends who are my age who are like, oh, yeah, we're doing this. We're demoing. We're sending it out to this and this. I'm like, dude, fucking stop. Stop.
Yeah.
Like, enjoy your fucking life.
Yes.
And play music for the reason you want to play music. And you're going to write fucking better music.
Yeah.
Like, stop chasing the serpent.
Yeah,
because the serpent's a fucking asshole, and you might like catch his head every once in a while, but probably not.
Yeah,
and you got to go to sleep at night. You know,
like, can we please play the More You Know music after that?
Oh my god, the podcast.
Lizzie,
a PSA from Benny.
How is
the serpent
your
is an asshole?
Did I curse too much?
Well, sorry. Now that this serpent talk has come in, I feel like I have not been doing that much yoga.
I did my first ever Bikram yoga class with you, and I almost died.
Yeah, you're welcome.
Jonah does an incredible slithery serpent.
Lizzie is a yoga teacher.
I am a teacher.
She's a teacher.
Really?
Yes. Yeah.
She's a yogi, motherfucker.
It's real. I don't teach.
I told your book publicist. I was like, yeah, I met Lizzie through yoga. And she's like, oh, really?
Was she like, I'm sorry, what? Because like, I basically don't tell anyone that. I don't know why. I think it's because I like don't want to have to teach yoga ever.
Yeah.
And so I, not that I, of course, that's like...
Were you certified as a Bikram teacher?
No.
Okay.
No, I'm certified. I did my training at like Laughing Lotus. Do you
know
that?
Yes, I do know Laughing Lotus.
It's awesome. I had the best time. It was great. But I didn't, I don't teach yoga. So I always feel, I mean, I am not a yoga teacher. I'm like someone, I'm technically allowed to, like I will not be arrested.
How many hours was your training?
200 hours. And then I did another advanced training.
That's a lot of hours.
Yeah, that is a lot.
Yeah.
If you had to
do a yoga pose right now, and I'll correct you.
If you had to rate Jonah's
form, my bird of paradise is tight
on a scale of 1 to 10.
I have not seen Jonah practice yoga.
It's been a long time.
Can you just bust something out and let Lizzie judge you? Come on, Jonah.
Okay, you know, Benny, there's no judgment in yoga. That's part of it. See?
What?
There's no wrong.
I swear to God, I'm in those classes, and the whole time I'm like, that lady behind me is like, what is this sweaty fat fuck doing?
Get
him out of this class.
See, is that Benny, that says so much about you and how you view yourself. This is yoga is the practice that we apply to diagnose our own mental, etc.
Listen, it's downward dog is no joke for a guy my size. This shit's hard.
It hurts, right? Yeah. It's totally hard.
I see these women in there judging me. Clearly judging me. I'm like, oh,
Benny,
try to hold 210 pounds
Benny,
up this
a friend of mine of just hair, said yo. A friend of mine just said recently to me that it's just like, you know, when you walk into a bar and there's and you want attention from the opposite sex, but the less that you need that, the more it'll just come to you. Yoga is the same way. Nobody's really watching. I mean, like, just do your thing and then it'll all, I mean, yeah.
See, but I'm watching.
Yeah, that's your problem.
Why do they have a mirror?
That's your problem right there. No mirrors. Don't go to a mirror yoga studio. No. Just, you know, be present.
That's why they call it a practice.
I do. Well, that's why I gave up on the classes. My meditation practice is still pretty sharp.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, don't give up. Wait a
minute. No, I gave up on the classes. Now I do this like super old man yoga.
Yeah, that's the way to go.
20-minute session I found on YouTube that's like, I barely move.
Sounds fantastic.
But it really centers me.
Send me that link. Send me that link immediately.
I like yoga with no exercise.
Yeah.
That's what I'm into.
Okay.
You know?
Well, that's also yoga, though. Jonah will tell you.
But yoga with exercise, it gets too hard for me to think. That's when I'm like, Jesus Christ, this hurts.
You're not supposed to be
thinking. I'm not thinking anymore.
You're not supposed to be thinking.
Yeah.
But I can't even think about breathing at that point because I'm just like.
See, this is a test conversation for me because this really does make me want to teach you yoga.
It does?
Yeah.
You should. You should get
maybe,
it.
Maybe this is your audience. People like us who are like, yeah, we're missing something.
Listen,
you can clearly connect
we want to be taught by not the guy trying to bang the girls in the front row.
Yeah, disgusting men.
Lizzie, you finish the book's done. Do your victory lap and then you get back into your yoga career.
Okay.
This is going to be super lucrative. Okay. Trust me.
Yeah. Here are my plans for making money. Writing books and teaching yoga. I think there's a problem here.
So
I
should have.
I do not like Brooklyn. I'm anti-Brooklyn, basically. So, no. I go there a lot, but I like try not to acknowledge it.
So book reviews are really pretentious.
Yeah, I haven't I guess there are some out. I don't know.
I've
how
never
many
looked
there.
Into them too much.
Yeah,
and then I'm doing research for
way.
This interview.
Yeah.
By the way, they're mostly glowing reviews.
Oh, good.
But
okay.
I feel
are there
like,
some douchey ones? Let's hear it.
No, the thing I found douchey about them is I would say there's like a 5 to 10 word cap per review of words that are totally unnecessary, and they're just using. Because they know how to use those words.
So it's like SAT words that they've decided to be like, yo, I'm a book reviewer. Like, how about this word you have
basically,
to look up?
The language was mellifluous. I found it disconcerting upon the denouement.
Okay, you've been ghostwriting.
That's about right. Yes.
I now know. They're all by Steven, you guys.
I feel like there's a mentality, too. Like, I feel like
I
a lot of people
safety pins.
Don't like.
Yeah, right.
I feel like that's also why a lot of people don't like that show, Girls. Like, I feel like there's a lot of, like, attitude of, like, well, yeah, I could have actually done a better job of this. And it's like, dude, you didn't do anything, though.
I love that. One of the funniest questions, like, I tried to, you know, before I was going to start doing press for this, it was like, what's that going to be like? Like, I always ask all the questions, like, what's that going to be like? And one of the questions that came up that I did not anticipate that I find hilarious is literally people have been asking me, a lot of them. Here's what I'll get. I have interviewed a lot of these bands. They're not very friendly. How did you get them to say all this stuff? And you're like, I don't know how to respond to that without saying that you suck at your job. Like, I don't know what to
try
tell you.
Try not to be a tool.
Yeah, like,
that's your get. Sorry. I know exactly
please,
how you feel.
What else do you have? What else can I say?
Because it's.
Give me some more
haven't,
responses.
Haven't been on that side. And Jonah, who's an exceptional interviewer, and people adore him. Like, he's not disliked.
Come
He'll
on.
Say that's not true.
It
but,
is true.
Even people I know
like
who have been angry at Jonah, I've seen, will talk to him.
Many people.
And you can get them to open up. I've seen it. You know what I mean? But it's. I know exactly what you're saying. It's like,
weird.
How did you get them to say that? And you went, well, I listened, and then I followed up with something that I hadn't planned because
what
they said was more interesting than what I thought they were going to say because I'm not them and I can't predict the future.
I feel
totally.
Like...
Totally. High five.
Lizzie, this is something I can give you a little advice on.
All right, I'm
I've
ready.
Been interviewed a lot.
Have you?
I have. And
by
yeah,
me, even.
Some, by me,
little.
Too.
Yeah, but a little.
You guys are actually interesting.
Fuck, I've interviewed you, just, too. Jesus.
You know, you
weird.
Guys are the good ones where you feel like you're in a conversation.
Yeah.
Which is the trick. But there are two ways to go about horrible questions.
Okay, yeah, please.
One, Derek Jeter it.
Okay.
Which means say a bunch of shit without saying anything.
Yeah, yeah, that's the one
just
I've
give the,
with.
You know, I go out there, I give 110%. I just do it for my team. I do it for the... He was... he said so much shit.
This is from Bull Durham. Do you know the
I just went to Ricky Bobby, actually. Okay. I'm not sure what to do with my hands. Like, there's that way.
We're not going to call you Nuke.
Say a lot without saying anything. Yes. Or the way I like, which is sort of the Jack White kind of way or something, make some shit up.
Just lie.
And it's more fun.
Okay.
Because, and you got to border on where reality meets fantasy.
Okay.
So they're not quite sure, and the reader's not quite sure.
Okay, and I like this.
Like, so when they're like,
my publicist is going
to
love
this. How did you get the strokes to open up?
Yeah.
You know, oh, I brought, you know, a hyperventilation chamber, and I gave him some drugs, and I put him in there, and then I did this, and then all of a sudden they just woke up,
it's
and
like
it was really
serum.
Easy to talk to.
Yeah.
Inari sushi,
oh,
not
like
unagi,
that.
Inari. It's
yeah, that's
tofu.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
Totally.
Specific.
Oh my God. Okay, this is good.
Or just like, how did you
play
get this
it.
Band? Fresh fish. Like, if you say that and nothing else, right?
What a, I like
just
it.
Without missing a beat.
Yeah, boom.
Boom.
And if
okay.
they say what kind, you go Sable. What
wait.
The fuck
yeah, you just roll with
were
it.
Were those both, was there another way it could go?
Yeah, you either Derek Jeter it or you fresh fish it.
That's
yeah.
it? There's not
that's
like
it.
A
two
third?
Ways.
Or you get like angry actually trying to answer it, which I don't like to do.
That's a non-option.
Especially if you're getting interviewed by Germans or something. Like,
yeah,
you gotta,
dude, it's the best.
You got to grow a sense of humor fast if you don't want to like be miserable at the end of that, you know?
Well, you also just want to, you want them to get to the next question. So like, yeah. I don't want to pick a fight. I mean.
No.
It's not in our best interest. So there is a third option, but we're deleting it.
Oh, okay. Yeah. No, yeah. Third option is just
three,
no,
but no
fun. No fun.
No fun.
Yeah.
Okay. Fresh fish.
But
I'm going with fresh fish.
Yeah.
You have strategies. You know what you're doing.
Yeah. I mean, it's what you, do I know what I'm doing when it comes to being interviewed? I don't know.
Disarmingly charming.
Yeah.
Ooh.
I just try to charm interviewing is exactly what you said. I mean, I always think the actual answer to that question is exactly what you said. Like, how do you get people to say stuff? You prepare and then forget everything you prepared and show up and have a conversation with someone and see where they take you. And trust that you don't know anything anywhere near as much as of what you want to hear from this person as they do.
Mm.
And if you just put your attention on them, you will see things that you wouldn't have known to see. You couldn't have possibly imagined, and then that will be your story.
See, that's a hell of a tip right off the bat.
Yeah, man.
Is that,
but that's what you just said.
Yeah. Is that idea that you actually want to hear what they
it
say.
It makes all the difference in the world. Because, like, yeah, I mean, I've had the experience so far of that thing that is the worst, where you're, like, being asked questions and you can tell that they are literally reading a list and they're waiting for you to stop talking.
Right.
And you're like, you know that I'm actually going to give you the material. Let me help you make your story
right,
more.
Right.
Nope. And they're like, and this is how you, it sounds. Okay. And so how did you know when you were going to write the book? And you're like, oh
Jesus.
Okay.
Yeah.
You know, but I mean, it's not, it's.
Sometimes they're editing in their head. You know, they're thinking, I got to put this together this way, which is not the
sure.
best way to do it.
That also happens, but don't do that.
Here's my thing is that you, when writing stuff, whenever I would talk to anybody, I would say off the bat, I don't care who you're fucking or where you were last night. Like, I don't care.
Yeah.
Let's talk about your band or whatever. With this book,
yeah.
there's more than just the music. There's a lot. So how do you siphon that down and sift out? Because, you know, it always amazes me when people like, it's like, you know, Carly Simon. It's like, who's you're so vain about? I don't care. I like the song.
Good song.
You know, but then at some point, you know, then that becomes part of the myth that becomes stronger than the song.
Who's Mr. Wendell?
Who's Mr. Wendell, which we were talking about
earlier.
Before you showed up.
Okay.
A nice piece of exposition of a conversation.
Apparently,
that wasn't
homeless people are not materialistic.
Okay.
If you look at the Mr. Wendell Wikipedia.
Okay.
We looked that up.
Okay, you guys were busy before I got here. I'm glad you were on top of things.
Thanks, Thurston. Oh, sorry, Joe.
Nah, I don't care.
Oh, God.
Sorry, Stephen.
No, I'm just saying, like, how do you weed out, how do you decide what's personal that's goes in the story related to New York music?
I mean, I think that in this case, well, first I did a potential, I mean, it is a tricky thing, I guess, that I did. But basically, unlike in regular journalism where, like, I'm pretty strict about when representatives or managers or publicists will be like, okay, but you just can't ask them about this. I'm like, then no. I mean, no matter what it is, not because it's like, because they're always trying to protect against something that probably isn't even that interesting because they will give you a shitty quote about it anyway because they're uncomfortable. Like, no, but I don't like this idea that you're going in with parameters. I just think it's dangerous and makes for a bad conversation. So it's not like you don't, I've never done that. But in general, if someone says, I can't talk about X, Y, and Z, but I will be interviewed by you, I'm like, then we shouldn't do this interview because you're not ready.
What was it like for you doing that Conor Oberst piece? Because that must have been, I can imagine that was like, there's like such a huge elephant in the room. And you were like the only person really to profile him.
But that was greenlit. I mean, I did not sit down with him with any parameters on what I could talk about.
Got it. I was curious about that.
Yeah, I mean, that Conor is, God, he's so amazing. I mean, he's such a... I was so happy to have him in this book, and he's certainly one of the good ones, to put it mildly. But yeah, that piece was really intense for obvious reasons, and just because of what he'd been through and how excruciating it was, and how it was important to me as somebody who's, especially as somebody who's writing more and more about feminism and sort of issues of social equality from the feminist perspective in art in general, to go and tell that story too, because I considered what happened to him to be like a huge setback for women's rights, basically. So that was really key. I really wanted to tell that story, but we had talked a lot about when it was going to be a good time to do that. And basically I wouldn't have done that piece if there had been rules about what we could talk about.
That was like the Stoya story.
Oh my God.
That was, I mean, talk about the
pro-women
feminist
PTSD
story.
I keep like being like, oh, I like that story. I was like, oh yeah, Lizzie wrote that. Lizzie wrote that.
Oh my
Lizzie
God,
wrote that.
Yes.
Yeah, dude.
Thank you. That Stoya story was also really intense.
That was really intense. That was intense to read. That was like...
That was intense to... Oh my God.
I can't imagine going through that. Like you're...
She's amazing too. These people are so amazing. It's just, you're so gratified that anyone is willing to go there with these incredibly personal, like harrowing experiences. And I guess that's what I mean. Like either I can't do this job very well if there's sort of parameters in advance, not because it affects all these other things you don't even realize it's affecting. Like it makes your conversation stilted. It makes everything else feel like, well, wait, is that line going to lead me to this thing that's out there? So basically where I was going with this, not that I'm not happy to talk about Stoya, because I am, because she's amazing, but is that with the book, I told people basically, I mean, I always honor off the record, like always, basically, unless you call me 6 days after the interview and are like, actually, can you not print any of that? Like in general, like it's like, all right, you know, 2 hours later, you're uncomfortable with this, whatever. Off the record is always game with me. In this book, I told people that they could talk about whatever they wanted. So people who wanted to participate and go all out and tell me everything that they did and use it as a kind of airing out healing therapy session, which there are plenty of people who did that in the book, as you can read. Great. People who wanted to come in for 20 minutes and say 3 things about band practice one day that their other band members had brought up. Great. I just sort of cast in a way that I wouldn't for a piece of journalism in the same way. It's not like I said there are you can tell me parameters, but I said I'm not going to push you on anything that you like. You tell me what you want to remember from this period of time, because as I said, the main character, the allegiance to the story is New York. So if you were involved there at one period of time and were important to that story in any way, like, I just want to hear a little from you, but you don't have to carry the weight of the entire piece. Whereas if Conor Oberst is like, if they're like, we want you to do a profile on Conor Oberst, but you can't talk about this huge thing that has had him in the news that basically like, you know, not ruined his life, but caused a lot of problems for him emotionally and affected the record that he's written and shaped what's been said about him in the press for the last couple of years. You can't talk about that. It's like, then I can't write about him. You know, I can't. But this book, that wasn't true in the same way. But this is the thing about oral history. When people hear what other people are talking about, all of a sudden what they want to talk about shifts. So...
Right.
I would often go to an interview and say, tell me what you remember about 9/11. Tell me what you remember about like tell me one just really easy, like fun conversations. What was your favorite bar? What's your favorite show that you saw? Like, if you had to describe your average night in 2003, like the most fun part of your band, what was that? Blah, blah, blah. But then as it got closer to an actual structure, you would have to say, okay, so I just want to let you know that all four members of your band, who I've already talked to, talked about your first rehearsal and said X, Y, or Z happened, even if it's not controversial. And all of a sudden, that person would pretty invariably be like, okay, well, actually, I think we played this song first. And actually, and so oral history does lend itself to I think, forcing people in a way I didn't quite realize at the beginning to comment on things they might not have initially wanted to comment on.
Your side, my side, the truth, that kind of thing.
It's Rashomon, though. I mean, people, this book is not true. Like, it's not, oh, now I know what happened.
Right.
It's, that's the point. Like, that's why I wanted to do it as oral history, even though a crazy person decided that did not understand how much work it was going to be. But I knew it was not a good idea to try to, like...
Pre-cabin, Lizzie.
Yeah. Yeah. I was like, the person that used to be able to survive New York City decided that was a good idea. This person no longer thinks that. But you can't tell what happened to this many people, like anything like accurately, or B, I'm certainly not qualified to be the sort of like, I don't know, like voice from on high that comes down and settles the debate about whatever, any number of things that come up in this book. You have to let everyone have their say. And the truth is the emotional resonance of how it feels to read it. And hopefully that syncs up somewhat with how it felt to be there. And still no one knows what happened, which is like life, you know?
That's a thin clap. That was a good one, man.
It's fine.
So let me give you a little behind the scenes. Well, first of all, thanks to Lizzie for coming by.
Lizzie, that was great.
That was great. Pick up her book, Meet Me in the Bathroom. I read it. It's great. It takes a little while because it's like 500 or 600 pages, but it goes very fast. Which is a testament to Lizzie.
Do I get mentioned in the book a lot? Or?
There's a whole chapter about you, Brad.
There is.
There's this whole chapter about how the Goops inspired the Strokes. which is a lot of people don't know about, but I don't want to give that away. But yeah, when we do these outros, you have to clap in order to see where it gets broken up. That's a little peek behind the veil, and Brad thinks I suck at clapping.
Dude, don't give away.
And you
secrets.
Also suck at giving technical descriptions of technique.
Wow. Yeah, so Brad, thanks for booking Lizzie on the podcast. That was really cool of you to do. And this is like the most like passive aggressive. Can we start over? Let's start over. I don't like that.
Come on, it's so revealing.
All right, fine. Thanks, Lizzie, for coming by. Now you guys can see the real Brad. I know he seems like such a nice guy.
We're at the end. There's nobody here right now.
There's no one
here. Are you here? Because maybe this is why we don't get any fucking money, because this is how we wait till now to ask for it.
If you want to donate, do I have to even do this? If you want to donate, you can figure out how to donate. Venmo at Off Track. You can send us money via PayPal. You can leave us a review on iTunes. You know the drill.
Subscribe, love us. Send us vibes.
Yeah, tweet at us.
Tweet at Jonah.
Whatever. Tweet at me. I went to a show. I went to go see the Menzingers the other night, and there was a guy from England who's a fan of the podcast.
What was his name?
I don't remember. He sent me a very nice message.
Oh, cool.
So
thanks, dude.
Yeah, he made me look really cool in front of Jeff Rosenstock. We were hanging out, and I was like, Jeff, hold on, man. I gotta talk to a fan. Excuse me.
I know a British guy.
Yeah, I was like, I know this is very rude.
It's good that he had an accent, too.
Yeah. No, it was cool. He also has a podcast. What's it called? Like, I wish I could remember the name of his podcast.
Is it like Biscuits with the Queen or something?
Yes, that's it. It's called Biscuits with the Queen. It's something like...
I know that podcast.
Boredom or something about being bored or something like that. I don't know.
I'm so bored with the USA.
Yes, that is it. But yeah, thanks to Lizzie for coming by. Sorry this outro is so bad. And we'll be back with another podcast next
Never
week.
Never apologize.
Bye.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.